Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 212, Archetypal Dream Work with Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I don't think it's an extraordinary thing for a dream to reveal a future thing. I think the extraordinary thing for a dream to reveal is how we can change the future, how we can change our pattern that replicates the same cycles of behavior and responses from the world until the end of our lives. The idea is to get off the wheel and to find the true path, and that's within ourselves. That's what's extraordinary.
That was the voice of Mark Bregman, one of today's two guests. Today I interview Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster about an approach they call archetypal dream work. Mark Bregman founded Archetypal Dream Work in 1973 and is the co-founder and co-director of North of Eden and the Center for Archetypal Dream Work. Mark is an archetypal dreamwork therapist in practice since 1973, a teacher and trainer of teachers. He's the author of The Deep Well Tapes, The Secret of the Pomegranate, Sex, Trauma, and Conjunctio, and Hubris of the Heavens, Archetypal Dreamwork, and Rudiharian Astrology, and is currently working on two books, The Practitioner's Guide to Archetypal Dreamwork and Gravity, a biography with Susan Scavo. Mark has a bachelor's degree in religion from the University of Vermont and a master's degree in special education from Johnson State College. Mark worked for the United States Postal Service and as a social worker for the state of Vermont before becoming a full-time therapist. Mark was born in Philadelphia, spent 3 years in the Army, and traveled for several years before settling in Vermont. Also in this interview is Krista Lancaster. And Krista Lancaster is the co-founder and co-director of North of Eden and the Center for Archetypal Dream Work. Krista is a therapist in practice since 1991, a teacher and trainer of teachers. She's the co-author with Mark Bregman of The Deep Well Tapes, Sex, Trauma, and Conjunctio. And it includes her spiritual memoir of her journey through this work called Vessel. Krista has led groups and events for archetypal dream work since 1992 before co-founding North of Eden. She completed the certificate program at the New England Art Therapy Institute and spent 5 years studying with Pathwork Vermont. She attended Brown University and has a bachelor's degree in art history from Barnard College. Her years of experience working with groups underlie the North of Eden retreat process. Krista was born in Bermuda and spent her teenage years in England before moving to New York City in 1976 and settling in Vermont in 1987. Now, let's go to the interview. Actually, before we do, I should mention that about a third of the way into the interview, you'll hear bits of static when I'm speaking. I've done my best to minimize this annoyance by going back and re-recording my comments and questions that were most plagued by static. I'll say more about this after the interview, but now let's get into it. Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hello.
Thank you.
Well, you two are doing something that you call archetypal dream work. How did you get involved in working with dreams in the first place?
Well, on my side, Chris is a client and who is now trained to be an analyst. And on my side, I was always driven inside to find a relationship with something more than the world that I experienced. And a lot of personal traveling from LSD to India to reading esoteric literature, et cetera, et cetera. I landed on Carl Jung and found it lacking in personal intimacy and personal experience with the divine, at least in terms of his writings. And so that being said, it really doesn't answer the question because I don't have the intelligence and the spiritual know-how to really do anything about it. But for me, as I was working with clients and struggling with the materials, not really knowing where I was going, I had this voice come up to me just saying what I was to do with the client. Just like, say this, say that.
Wow.
Do this, do that.
Was it like an audible voice or just kind of an internal presentiment?
Internal voice separate from me that I had never heard. And in my spiritual struggle to find a divine reality, this was a shock. But I just did it, and it seemed wrong. As every time I hear the voice and listen to it, it always seems wrong, but I do it. And out of that came a beginning understanding of the work at a level that I didn't know existed. And that was about 40 years ago.
Oh, okay. We're going way back.
Way back. And since then, I've grown in my own work with dreams and in my relationship with the divine. In terms of the work, it's not a religion, it's in terms of a spiritual understanding dreams as a way to a spiritual relationship that's on an emotional level, not on an intellectual level. All the books I read weren't really going to help me with what I was learning, because what I was learning was not in the books as such. I could see, well, yeah, this was here, that was here, but what I was being brought to with my clients was a level or a depth of personal journeying through the dreams that, as it's developed over the years, has become a unique experience for those that have traveled on the dream journey. And it has created quite a following of people who, having explored this and other things, feel like this is uniquely extraordinary and want to do the same. So we've developed a community called North of Eden. There's about 30 practitioners or who are learning the work, who have done the work or are doing the work and are moving into a relationship with the deeper aspects of the dream world and are ready to take others on a similar journey.
Okay, that's a very intriguing background. Now, I need to ask you, do you have any traditional training, licensing, certification, or is this all kind of from the ground up, inside out for you?
Well, it definitely is both. I did go to several colleges. I have a BA in religion. Where Jung was a really important part of the curriculum, and I did study under Freudian and a Jungian. I tried to understand that material long before I heard the voice and was doing work. I ended up with a master's in special ed at Johnson State, and I've done a lot of personal readings. No, I'm not a graduate of Zurich, nor am I a PhD. I think we've written 4 books now. We have 2 more coming. And the material is just the last 3 years just flowing out of the work. And I have people that I work with that are so connected to it that it's actually a co-authored book because they've work with the materials that come out of me and they put it, their own understanding to it. So it's actually a group process that we're doing. So, and because we're published self, that we put the books out on our own, we're not really officially considered authors. However, we have one fellow who's a client and a famous writer who wrote The Jew and the Lotus. And I don't know if you've heard of the book.
I have not. I saw it on your site.
Yeah, and he wrote a book about the work, which has legitimized us enough for him to get on the Oprah show, and that was about 1.5 years ago, and he's taken that as far as he can, and we're picking up the thread of what he began and feel strongly that we need to bring this work to the world and teach it and share it and make it available.
Yeah, what's his name, by the way?
Roger Kamenetz, K-A-M-A-N-E-T-Z.
Krista, maybe you should give us a little bit more on your background.
Let's see. Well, I arrived in Vermont 21 years ago, and having at age 29, and having left a bad marriage behind, and I found someone who gave me a card that had Mark's name on it and said, "I really think you should call this person." And so I went home that night, and I did. And I began to work with Mark with my dreams, and I went along every week, and I didn't have a clue about what was really going on. But something in me that had been seeking throughout my adult life for a way to become who I knew on some level that I needed to be, and to, I knew that there were people that I needed to find and that there was work that I needed to do. So I've been working with my dreams for that long, for 20 years, and sort of early on, Mark would ask me to, you know, ask me if I would lead a group, or I'd go on the radio show and talk about this work, and he was very much wanting to stay in the one-on-one relationship with his clients, and my knack was more for being in groups, and I was training to do group work at a couple of other training institutions, and over the years, I had the sort of interesting apprenticeship where I just began to lead group activities and group support groups and different forms of people coming together. And that over time developed into what Mark was talking about, North of Eden. And so, you know, as time has passed and a group of people have really formed the collective that Mark spoke of, I just sort of naturally fell into leading the group process, which has become a sort of extraordinary form of therapy we call string therapy, which we do in the group setting at our retreat center.
Well, I'm going to want to hear about that in some detail.
Yeah.
But first, let me ask you, when I hear the word archetypal, I immediately think of Jung and also James Hillman. So and Mark, you said something about Jung, and I'm wondering to what extent your work is rooted in their thinking, either Jung and or Hillman or anybody else who listeners might have heard of that's influenced it.
Absolutely. And all the credit due. One of the problems that the best way to say it is that in Carl Jung's famous dream where he's going down these steps and comes to deeper layers in the underground, in the subterranean, and finally goes down to the deepest point, and he finds two skulls side by side. And that dream he wakes up from, and I guess he understands there's such a thing as the collective unconscious, a deeper realm where there are these archetypal entities or spiritual reality. And that interpretation of Carl's dream is not my own. I would say that the skulls are telling Dr. Jung that the archetype is dead to the world, or dead to him, both. And I recognize intensely, because I know a lot of Jung, of trained Jungians, who have not had an experiential encounter with the divine. They understand it in a metaphorical or a mythological or on a collective level where you're talking about certain symbolic themes. So that people in analysis, they talk about things in a very rarefied intellectualism, where actually the encounters and dreams are pulling at the deepest aspects of our psyches, which we repress. It's part of the neurosis we all live under, where we suppress the material that is really the essentially true self. The dreams are pushing that material back up into the consciousness, and Jungian work and other work does not really seem to be able to free up that energy or a Reichian kind of primalcy that actually has consciousness. So dreams become actually feed the neurosis, feed the mind that evaluates and thinks and forms, but it doesn't allow the more spontaneous self that has a reality that can only be experienced through feeling. So it's for this work, the understanding for us is that the dreams are trying to not just tell you something, but are trying to free deep inner feelings up that actually are the beginnings of a new kind of an awareness. It's not just freeing up energy so you could work harder or drive a golf ball farther. It's energy that actually allows you to have a spiritual awakening on a feeling level. And that, I would say, is the difference between what how the dreams are worked with us is to follow the dream intention, which is to evoke those feelings. And that's very different from what many, I'm not going to say all, because there may be, I have written many students of Carl Jung who some of them get pretty close to what we're trying to do, and some of them actually seem like they're doing the same thing. But by and large, it is a limited field as far as the understanding and application to dreams to this method.
Yeah, let me ask you, a couple of times you've referred to the divine, and so, of course, that's a... I think people are going to wonder, well, what version of the divine are you talking about? Is your work rooted in Christianity or some other religious perspective? How would you speak to that?
It's clearly, Dr. Jung was extraordinary in his ability to try to stand aside from the religions of the time and stand in a spiritual place where the psyche or the divine aspects of the psyche had a personal relationship with that individual through dreams. And the awareness that came from that, he certainly did have an awareness of this, and I've learned that that's the meat and potatoes of what this work is that's being presented. But the point that I want to make in that is that it's personal, and its application into the world can be evolved into any, if a person's a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Christian or Jewish person, it doesn't matter. Those, and basically most people would say, they're all really saying the same thing. It isn't really about the rituals that are important as far as this work. It's what you experience. And if in terms of your deeper understanding and awakening, becoming a whole, alive, more conscious person, you feel like Zen is the way for you, then Zen's fine. It's not the houses you live in where you find the divine. You find them in your own heart, and the application to some kind of religiosity is that's personal to you is not a disagreement. So I don't teach anything to do with religions, or I have people that come from all walks and all ways. But the message is always the same, that a person must find their soul, he must find their deepest self to really commiserate with the divine. And it's that work that I think in the underpinnings of all the religions you find, at least in the more fanatical roots of it, you find those people that were working on themselves at that in that way. But that's very hidden and part of the mystery that is very rarely seen in any religion, but it's there in every one of them.
Okay, Krista, I know in an email, I think you mentioned that you had listened to my interview with Arnold and Amy Mendel, and I'm wondering if your work is at all close to their work. I have the impression that they've tried to root their work very much in the body and in feeling.
You know, I don't think I could really speak to their work. I years ago I read his book on the dream body, and so I don't know, David, if I can really compare. That probably isn't what I could do.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask you then, either one of you, where do you see dreams coming from? Well, first of all, what do you see as the purpose of the dream? I think, Mark, you've hinted at that, but...
Well, the way that Mark's grabbing his phone, but I'm going to grab my first shot of it.
Sure, jump in.
That the dreams are coming from that source within us that is the divine, and that in my experience working with people, that every single dream has an intention that would want us to open to a deeper realm of ourselves. And it is the process that's evolved through the work that Mark sort of discovered years ago, or it discovered him, is a way to decode the language of the dream so that the door can open to the feeling realm, which leads down into and back towards the self that we had to jettison at different, whatever stage of this life or the one before. So I think that we work from the dream is always being generated by the soul self that wants us to know ourselves.
Okay. As you may know, I've been working with dreams myself for maybe 30 or more years and teach a class on the subject. And while I think dreams do a lot of different things, I think the main place I come from, and this is probably rooted in my background as a clinical psychologist and therapist, is that I do think that dreams are very much about feelings and our emotional lives and our emotions and our very concrete lives. And so I'm wondering if that's what you're talking about when you say dreams are about feelings and experience.
There's two answers to that. I'm going to let Krista answer. I'm going to let her answer the second one, which I know you're going to go for, which is the personal.
Right.
But I want to answer the other one, which is the spiritual. Oftentimes, when people have experiences, we call it the three stages of the work, and I'll just talk about that, and Krista will answer about the feeling self. In the first stage of the work, the reality is that, unfortunately, that people in the dream is presented usually the wrong way. That because the person already has opinions and thoughts and ideas that are wrong, often in stage one dreams, good is actually comes to you in the dream is bad. And bad comes to you in the dream is good. Not always, but enough that you really have to know what you're doing. And
now that's confusing to me. I don't know what you mean when you say good comes with bad and bad comes with good.
Well, oftentimes if people haven't dealt with their fears, then oftentimes something positive will come in a way that terrorizes the dreamer.
Oh, okay.
The dreamer or the client, I'm sorry, the analyst might then conclude that whatever's coming at them is bad. In fact, it's almost always the case in the interpretation of Freudian dreams. Anything bad that Freud ever had in a dream was bad. In reality, everything Freud ever had in a dream that I ever read about his dreams weren't bad. They were good. It's just that he was confused about his own fears. So the first stage, which is the hardest one to work through, is the treacherous one where people's opinions and feelings about things are typically wrong. And the analysts have to, and that was what was scary for me when the voice started telling me things. It told me things that were opposite to what I thought. And in fact, I was worried that the client would be infuriated with me for having disagreed with such an obvious point of view. I later learned, because I'm an obedient guy, because I was frustrated with my life, wanted to kill myself a bunch of times, couldn't stand the way the world was or the way that I was, I finally figured, well, I'm just going to listen. For a change. It's hard for me to do, but yeah. I learned to do it. And I was obedient, which is not my way. And I actually said what was told. And the client looked at me and went, how did you know that? And it wasn't that I'm a psychic person. It was the things I was told to say were clearly, as I was later to see, were in the dream. They just were opposite what I thought.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. A typical example of that is... I would say the classic dream is of a bad man chasing you down the street. And I would say probably 80% of the time that bad man is a good man. And 20% of the time that bad man may really be a bad man. There are negative forces in the psyche that bad can be bad. But when the bad man's good, what you're dealing with such a person is a person who's terrified somewhere in themselves and have formed strong opinions and they don't want to face their fears, believing that the things I'm afraid of are valid. What if the things you're afraid of are actually good? What if fear is actually a door to something wonderful? Well, it turns out that is often the case. Not that I ever thought that. I'm not that smart, believe me. But when I was shown this, and then I actually applied it to people's dreams, and I saw that it was true, and they could actually then the dreams changed and began to, when one thing was learned correctly, the dreams actually changed into different kinds of dreams that affirmed what we did was correct. That's when I really began to understand that dreams did make sense if you got it right. If you didn't get it right, they just didn't make sense, and you just went around and around, never really seeing movement.
Well, actually, what you've just said is something that I and most of the other dream workers that I know also believe.
Well, then we're in agreement. That's a good thing to believe.
Yeah, right. You know, I think we might say this is the shadow or some unrealized part of the person that's coming as a nightmare, and that in fact, it's an opportunity for growth if they're willing to work with that, with what's coming up.
Right, and then the feelings that come up around that are what I would call the first order of feelings that relate to the dream themselves, to the deeper unconscious feelings that emerge. It's not just the thing in itself that's scaring you. It's the actual feeling of fear or other things. And one more point, and then I'll pass it over to Chris, that in this work we believe that some things aren't feelings that are feelings. Some feelings are actually emotions, which are pathological insofar as they represent a reaction to deeper feelings. And so one of the real things that have to happen to people, they have to be able to differentiate, or the analyst, what for a client is a feeling and what for a client is an emotion.
Now, to me, those two words are synonymous.
I know they are, but I'm sharing with you that they're absolutely the key to unlocking the psyche by being able to differentiate that there are mutated feelings that are emotions that pretend to be right, and the dreamer often believes them in their conscious life as correct. And because they believe it's correct, they justify themselves, and the dream is in conflict with that. And so the real extraordinary knowing that was given to me was that is the underlying way that you determine what is pathology and what is not. If you could determine what is a feeling and what is a mutation, which we call an emotion. In fact, there's truly the key to this work is just that thought. And I'll pass it over to Chris.
I get that explanation that you just gave, so thank you.
Yes, it's very critical to everything that's this work. Go ahead, Chris.
Mm-hmm. So what was the question, David? I've forgotten.
Who knows at this point? But
I think we need to start over.
Well, let's make this an opportunity for you to talk about your group work, you know, how you work with a group.
So a few years ago, someone in the circle of the group that we call NOE, which is the acronym for North of Eden, had a dream about working with dreams using a form of psychodrama, and actually using string in working with a group of people and an individual's dreams. And so we began experimenting as a group with this and finding a way to bring alive the elements of the dream and to show the connection of each element of the dream to the dreamer using string.
Okay, better define string for us.
That's it. That shows how the derivation of string therapy. And so we use, this is the group process that we use at our retreat center in northern Vermont, where we have 5-day retreats. And within small groups, we spend 5 days immersing in each person's set of dreams and using this form of string work. So that's the process that's evolved in terms of working the dream in a group setting. And then the larger question of the group is the sort of extraordinary group that's arisen out of this work in the last 18 or 20 years, that this, where we are in central Vermont, has evolved into a community where the lived experience of the dream work is happening. And a number of people in this area have become trained to lead groups at the retreats and to do the string therapy. And in fact, in the fall, we are opening a school to teach this work called the Center for Archetypal Dream Work. So
I still am struggling with string. Where did that word come from? How does it relate to what you do?
String, it's like the ball of string. It's like a string that strings the dreamer to different parts of the dream, to the part of the dream that, say, is represents the divine, the archetypal.
Or any connection to, it could be to pathology, when there's a connection.
Right, whenever there's a connection that is either felt, the way Mark is describing it, as a pathological connection or an archetypal opening. And so the energy of those parts becomes alive in the unconscious realm that is opened up through the group experience. And the strings
demonstrate that,
or they illustrate to everyone in the room where the connection is between the dreamer and the element of the dream.
And where it's not, by virtue of there being no string. So it's really a crutch. A lot of times we don't do it anymore because everybody's getting good at it. But if you're new, we would do that.
So the string is really a metaphor for kind of following the thread of the dream?
It's a metaphor for the connecting tissue between the dreamer and some form of the dream. Because in a dream, the dreamer is connected to some things who the dreamer believes are his allies and is not connected to other things who the dreamer believes are not his allies. And those alliances in dreams versus the non-alliances become the wharf and woof, if you will, of how the dream is reflected. Now, if you take three dreams together and bring them under one roof, which I do in one-on-one, I teach that too, but in the retreat center, and you bring all that together, you really see amazing drama unfold, which is sometimes the strings help other people to see, oh, that's how that connects. You take three dreams, put them together, and make one dream out of it, put strings on it just to help you see it. You see things that you didn't know were there. And the dreamer, who's the one that's being, this is being done to, other people play these roles, you see.
Yes.
So the dreamer just plays themselves. It's occasionally they might play other roles. They can explore that. But you have 8, 9 people in the group playing their different parts of their dream as it was dreamt with all the emotion of people who like to act and perform. It becomes like a living dream for many of them. And it's actually better than personal work.
Okay.
I mean, that's my own opinion. I love personal work, but I don't like group work, and I'm just like, I'm liking it now. I'm always wrong. Like I said, I'm learning to accept direction, and it's unbelievable what the retreats. We have a great center. We have a 48-bed dorm and a wonderful large room for eating and overlooking about 2,000 feet up, overlooking the valley. So, extraordinary place.
Oh, that does sound wonderful. Now, I didn't prepare you two for this question, but I wonder if one or both might be able to illustrate what you've been talking about by sharing one of your own dreams.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'm going to give you a recent one.
Good.
And then I'll give you maybe my first dream. And then I'll give you my most recent dream.
Great.
My first dream was I was in a nightclub in Paris and with a very good old friend of mine and his wife. And the wife handed me a baby, which I thought I was supposed to nurse. And the baby exploded and turned into rats, which skittered into all the corners of the nightclub. And I have to tell you, I had arrived in Vermont in 1988, having lived a life in Paris and New York and London and a lot of high heels. And but I had a failed marriage and kind of run away to Vermont. And I had absolutely no idea what this dream meant, except that, you know, it filled me with horror.
And you were about how old when you had the dream?
I was 29 years old.
Okay.
So this dream emerged that the baby, this is how I perceived the core of who I am, this baby. It was really, instead of knowing that core, I was filled with the shame, which the rats represented. And I had no idea that these rats represented my failed life, and that I had come to Vermont hitting the wall, and everything had sort of fallen apart, and had been in a really bad marriage where my husband had incorporated another woman into the marriage, and it was a very bad situation, and everyone was sleeping together, and I had given myself up in that way. So I sort of arrived in Vermont and had this dream, and got to see how bad things really were, and I had to face into my own issues about how I had arrived at that situation. So, been many, many years of working through all the layers of shame, and, to come back to that, to the child who was never touched by any of the circumstances of my life.
Well, thanks for sharing that dream. It's such a personal dream, and I definitely see how you came to see how it was related to the issues you were struggling with at that time. And then your more recent one?
Yeah, my most recent one, years later, you have to understand this is 20 years later, much working through. Recently I had a dream where there's a wild man driving a flatbed truck, and my oldest son, who's 26, and my black Labrador dog are on the back with a lot of different people from north of Eden. And I'm standing there worried that the dog is going to fall off the flatbed truck, and sort of standing on the sidelines. And meanwhile, the truck is about to go. And so what I did when I worked that dream was I had to get on the flatbed truck. And I don't know if you've ever been on the back of a flatbed truck, but there's no rim.
Nothing to hang on to.
Nothing to hang on to. So I got on the flatbed truck, and the man driving the truck would be the animus, the divine, and he is a complete wild man in my dreams. And he started going down the road, and my working with that dream was to just let go and to let him drive and let myself go. And we didn't bounce off the back of the flatbed truck. And as simple as this dream may sound, it opened up a whole new level of consciousness for me how I see this work is there's a moment where a dream, and you've probably encountered this in your work, where the sort of trap door opens and you fall further in. And this simple dream and the act of surrender of getting on to what looked really dangerous, was actually at this point in my journey, an extraordinarily opening experience.
And we want to relate it to the outer world, which has everything to do with you, Dave, because this whole idea of us and Krista, we're all on this flatbed truck together. It also has to do with his leading and this whole idea of the divine's involvement in the dreams. And when you follow your dreams, you're obedient to what comes out of that. And we've done this, and so we typically have these dreams where he's leading us and we're following in one way or another, or involved with him in one way or another, which is one of the goals of the work. And the idea of coming into the world from this very local cocoon place and presenting ourselves to the world, I know for Krista, you should comment on how scary that is.
Well, yeah. I mean, we all come to Central Vermont to leave the world that we, left very mm-hmm. specifically. And for me, I left New York City and, all kinds of a scene there. And a lot of people come to this area to lead a quiet life. And so I came to do that and to find what I was meant to be doing and to have this very localized sort of wellspring of spiritual growth develop into a public arena, and to find, you know, through Roger Kamenetz's, the publicity around his book, to find ourselves sort of out in the public eye has sort of been horrifying.
you kind of got catapulted.
We did.
On
we
this
got
wild ride.
David. There you are, a flatbed truck.
I'm on a flatbed truck. I'm just, somebody who wanted to get away from the bright light. So, and there we are. It's, the word would be exposure. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's very exposing, as I know you know from doing the work that you do, that to bring what is deeply within and personal out into a public arena, just as we are doing in this very moment.
Yes, I was just thinking the same thing.
It's terrifying and excruciating. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're just sitting here in my living room. So.
Yes. I asked you to help me out by sending me a few questions, and a lot of these have been my own questions, but I want to one of the ones that you gave me was, what are archetypes and what is pathology? So, you know, I'm sure we all have our own notions about that, but evidently you have some specific ideas. So let's hear what those are, archetypes and pathology.
Well, this goes back to what we talked about before about emotions and feelings, because, you know, the first question that a client might ask me, well, if things can be good in a dream that are good, and things in a dream that are good could be bad, and things in a dream that are bad can be bad, and things in a dream that are bad can be good, then, and you don't even know me, how are you going to possibly, how do you figure that out, Mark? And that's a question that I always ask them to ask me, because that's the point. Like, I'm going to be telling you things that you're not going to like because they're not what you accept as reality. And the dream breaks those ideas down as quickly as it can so that you can be ready for the real spiritual transformational growth, which is the alchemy work that Jung talks about, which we really know a lot about because of the numbers of people who have gone to that level, which we call second stage. But this is really the beginning part of really congruency with what the dream is and what you know. So that's really important that you get it right and quickly. So basically, to understand that emotions relate to pathology, and that the feelings relate to spirit or process, even if they're unformed or terrifying, they always grow. But emotions never change and never grow. So what you do is, by lining up a particular piece in a dream and by asking certain questions, after doing this work for so many years, I've become pretty good at, I can figure out really quickly what the emotion that the person is feeling and the behavior or beliefs that go with that. And by putting that out on the table really quickly, they can begin to see the pattern of their life that they've created out of those beliefs or emotions. And typically they are destructive, or they've led them to a point where they can't go any further in their growth. So the client will very quickly figure out, if the therapist is doing their job really easily in the dream, yes, these beliefs and these way that I feel about them have led me to these ways of being and living, and they can see that that's not really taking them as far as they want to go. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there, or they'll leave. That would be the last session for them. But if they really find that, yeah, I don't like the way my life is, it's got to go further. I've made some suppositions about myself that I now see that are not taking me where I want to go, and they can see that in the dream, and I can show them in their experiences, then they can see, okay, I can see where that's pathology. And then subsequent dreams, the dreams are unrelenting. They will keep coming session after session until that person fully understands the extent of what is in the way that they believe is good or bad, that they know or don't know or need to know is in the way of where the dreams want to take them. That's all represents pathology. The pathology isn't necessarily like something that's like dark. It could do positive things in a person's life. So, and the other problem is, too, is that love or hate or anger or jealousy or need or want, have meaning both as an emotion or as a feeling. So there isn't a good feeling or a bad feeling as far as a word that you can put on it. There are times when rage can even be a positive thing in the psyche. We use words without knowing what they really mean, and the dream shows us what it means in reality to itself. And so typically the dreams, as it belongs to the client, you're not really telling the client something they don't inherently know. The dream wouldn't tell you something that you weren't ready to hear because on some level you knew it. So it's not as difficult as it is, because you wouldn't have the dream unless you're ready to hear it. So that's an example of pathology. Christy, you want to pick up from this point?
Well, I'm just going to offer this a sort of simplified version of it that I spoke about the other day when we were doing a presentation somewhere. I think of the force of the archetypes as, in a really simplistic way, as, you know, in terms of Star Wars, it's the force that wants us to be who we are. And pathology as the posing force that is that which lurks in the universe and within, that wants us not to emerge and be who we really are.
Okay, good. What about the idea of dream incubation, that is, of posing a question to one's inner self to ask a dream to provide an answer? Do you guys do that at all? Do you have a take on it?
You know, you might say that from a spontaneous way that occurs, but the thing that I always look at is after a session and the client comes back, I'm looking for where the dream then wants to show me, not just the client, where I made a mistake. So I'm looking for correction. The dream is alive and real as you and I on the phone chatting, if we become that present with it, or the psyche is. So I'm looking for more like, okay, where do we go from here? The true teacher is the dream.
Okay.
So, yeah.
What's your take on precognitive dreams, telepathic dreams, etc.?
I don't know what,
Did you think that dreams sometimes show us things from the future?
Sometimes. I know that that's true. But I try to make the dreams more about the client I think seeing things that are going to happen is actually not an extraordinary event. I think that the psyche generally knows things because most of us are caught in patterns that you can predict a person's life once you know them pretty easily, what's going to happen next. So most things are known because people's patterns actually, if you really stood back and knew a person's life, you could probably predict what was going to happen anyway. I don't think it's an extraordinary thing for a dream to reveal a future thing. I think the extraordinary thing for a dream to reveal is how we can change the future, how we can change our pattern that replicates the same cycles of behavior and responses from the world until the end of our lives. The idea is to get off the wheel and to find the true path, and that's within ourselves. That's what's extraordinary. We always think in our arrogance that we know, we make ourselves and la la la. Well, we really don't. We've already locked into a direction that if we like it, fine, but really the future is already in us. What we want to do is find the future that is innate and potential in us, that the future that the divine has for us, not the one that our neurosis has for us. And so that's what's extraordinary, that we can have an entirely different experience of life, and that's what we're going for through the dream work.
Okay. What's your take on Jung's idea of little dreams and big dreams?
I guess I don't know his ideas of little or big. For me, they're all great, and they all have a message.
I guess what I'm getting at is that some dreams just knock your socks off. They just feel like they've come from some other place that's very, very powerful, and other dreams feel just kind of ordinary.
It's just we have to have the wherewithal to understand what the intention is. There's no accidental small dream. And I think that goes back to Dr. Freud and his quick way of interpreting dreams as stress-related or having certain outer experiences. I've not found that to be, except that maybe I couldn't figure it out, and that's my failure, not that the dream was ever small.
Okay, let me take you back. I want to kind of get a sound bite here, if you will, where you mentioned a couple of times the three stages of the work, and I wonder if just in a sentence or two or three, you can tell us what those three stages are.
Stage one is where you learn congruence, where you learn where your beliefs are out of sync, where those corrections are made. Second stage, and they can overlap, is the stage where the archetypes become more involved. You're working through your feelings dyadically with your emotions. You're working more and more in an alchemy where dreams and the work with dreams causes consciousness to change, to experience things that change you inwardly and outwardly. And finally, the third stage is when the archetype and the intimacy with the archetype expands to the point where you're actually being asked to do things in the world differently than what you, like I call it the beginning of a calling, that you begin to be called to something that is not, would be something you would normally do. That in the dreams would basically say to you, well, now that you know this, this is what I want you to do. That's the most advanced form of the work, and only happens after people have really come through the dying of self and the emergence of the soul self in consciousness.
Well, your work sounds absolutely fascinating, and as we start to wrap up here, I'm just wondering if there's anything that you haven't gotten a chance to say that you'd like to get out there, either one of you.
Well, I think the thing that Mark just mentioned was what I was wondering how we were going to scoot it in, the phrase dying to self, because really this work is that's centrally what it is about. And that's not necessarily something that has a popular spin on it at this time, but the dying of self, the actual, parts of the false self dying, so that the real self can emerge. I think it's a thing that I would want to underline before we close today.
Excellent. Mark, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think that I have a reluctance to say those things because I want the audience to like us, but thank you, Krista, for making sure we were honest.
I don't think it's unlikable.
Good. But you're a cool Dave.
Right.
We've gotten a few tomatoes a couple of
Okay. Well, look, Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster, thanks so much for being my guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It was a great pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye, Dave.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster. They have a very interesting website at www.northofeden.com, which will help you further understand their approach. After the interview, I asked if they knew about the IASD, the International Association for the Study of Dreams, and Mark said they just discovered the organization and are actually planning to do a presentation at the IASD's next annual conference. I asked them about IASD because in the interview, I got the impression that they might be somewhat isolated up there in Vermont and seem to be unaware of others who are doing some similar things. I'm sure there are uniquely powerful elements to their own work, but I'm still trying to get a fix on what those are. I would speculate that the community immersion and their weekend and week-long intensive retreats would be key elements. I think to further get a handle on what differentiates their approach, I'd like to do a follow-up interview with a fellow who was so affected by their work as to write a book about it, which ended up getting him on one of Oprah's shows. Mark and Krista mentioned him in the interview. His name is Roger Kamenetz, and the title of the book is The History of Night's Last Dream, Discovering the Hidden Life of the Soul. So stay tuned for that possible interview, which I'll explore setting up. Now, on a technical note, I hope you didn't find the static on my end too distracting. As I mentioned, I spent an hour or more re-recording some of the longer static-ridden portions. They only popped up on my side of the conversation, fortunately. For the past few months, I've occasionally noticed that static when recording my post-interview comments on GarageBand. I can't hear them as I'm recording, but I would notice them on playback. Typically, after I turn off and restart my equipment, the static will go away. This is the first time the static has cropped up in an interview, and it's got me worried. I can't hear it during the interview, only on playback. I'm going to try to monitor during future interviews, and maybe I'll be able to catch it. As a longtime ham radio buff, I've had a lot of experience troubleshooting equipment problems, and I can tell you that an intermittent problem like this is the hardest thing to track down because it happens so infrequently, and I can't make it happen on purpose. My best guess is that there's some electronic component somewhere in my chain of devices that's beginning to break down, perhaps due to heat. Generally, problems like this get worse over time, and I'm actually hoping that's the case because once it starts happening more often, I should be able to isolate which device is causing the problem. Those of you who are longtime listeners know how much time, money, and work I've put into trying to improve my sound, so you can imagine how distressing this latest development is to me. At the same time, I'm confident I'll get it figured out and solved sooner or later.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio.
It's shrink wrap radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello, friends. I'm still getting used to this every other week schedule. On the one hand, it's really giving me some breathing room. On the other hand, listeners keep sending me so many good guest suggestions, and that, combined with my own compulsive nature, make it very hard to keep myself reined in. When you post comments to the shows now, you'll notice that there's a CAPTCHA program on the site, one of those little boxes where you have to reproduce some non-machine readable text before you can post your comment. You know, sometimes they're really hard to read, but I don't think mine are that hard. I need to do this because I was getting slammed with about 100 spam comments a day for the past month or so, and that was taking me a lot of time to weed through them, and I may have even gotten so trigger-happy with the delete key as to accidentally erase some legitimate comments. I hope not, but if you posted a comment that never appeared, that would be what happened. Evidently, the CAPTCHA is not an impediment to legitimate comments because I've received several since installing it. Listener Honey Rococo sent me MP3 files of a recent interview with Dean Radin on the Art Bell Show. You'll recall Dean Radin from Shrink Wrap Radio number 197, and I imagine you can find the Art Bell interview if you Google Art Bell and Dean Radin. It's a good interview, and they also discuss Siluron, John Valentino's company. You'll recall I interviewed John recently about his work with random event generators and synchronicity on Shrink Wrap Radio number 210. A listener posted a very interesting comment, which triggered me to wonder if the recent death of Michael Jackson might have produced a global emotional response, which might have shown up on the network of these random event machines. So I fired off an email to Dean Radin, again of Shrink Wrap Radio number 197, and he got right back to me with research findings on that very question. If you go to the comments area of Shrink Wrap Radio number 210 with John Valentino, you'll find the URL to the research findings in relation to Michael Jackson's death and perturbations of the random number generators. Check it out. Four of you have posted very positive reviews of the show on iTunes in the last month or so, and that's certainly one of the things that's very helpful to our rankings. So if you have not posted a review on iTunes, let me encourage you to do so. Now be sure to hear my interview with Kristen Salello, PhD, on the history of marriage in 20th century America. While I usually interview psychologists rather than historians, I agreed with longtime listener Anna in Israel that her research would be relevant to our interests. Thanks for that suggestion, Anna, of the Anna is a Man blog. If you haven't done so already, please add yourself to our Frapper map. You'll find a link on our site, or you can simply go to frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio. Thanks for your donations. You'll find a big green donate button on our website. And, of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, Budget Car Rentals, Angie's List, and our newest sponsor, Avis Car Rentals. Also, listener Al Tabor is offering a deal on his vacation rental house in Inverness, California, not far from here, a luxurious coastal community. Look for the button on our site with a link to his discount rental offer.
Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is David Bradley. I'm a longtime listener, and I wanted to let you know about a new podcast I've started that you and your listeners might be interested in. It's called Psychoniclasm. It's an amateur, scientific, skeptical exploration into the field of psychology. Through interviews with experts and practitioners and discussing published research, I've examined topics such as astrology and alien abduction, with a few episodes on EMDR in the works. No topics are off limits. What I like best about your podcast is that you give interesting guests a lot of room to express their views and tell their stories without trying to argue with them. It's what makes your podcast so enjoyable. My favorite episode in that regard is the Scottish Ninja episode from last August. What I'm trying to do is take a closer look at the evidence for the claims my guests make when possible. I was wondering, are there times when you think you err too much on the side of credulity, accepting rather than challenging what your guests say? It's a difficult balance, as I'm finding out. I really enjoy your podcasts. Keep up the great work. And I hope you and your listeners stop by my website and let me know what you think. Psychoniclasm.com. PsychoniclasM.com. Talk to you soon.
I'm happy to report that I listened to the introductory episode of David Bradley's Psychoniclasm, which you can also find on iTunes, and I'm sufficiently impressed as to have become a subscriber. And David, to answer your question, yes, I do wrestle with my own credulity versus skepticism. You may not hear that so much in my interviews because I prefer a fairly non-confrontational style. And I find that I may be credulous during an interview, but as time passes, my skepticism may go up as more critical thinking kicks in. So I'll definitely be looking forward to seeing how you handle this rather challenging balance. Okay, let's go to some listener emails before we wrap things up here. First, we hear from H.R. St. John, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, firstly, I would like to say that I find your podcast positively fascinating. I am a freshman in high school where psychology is not offered, and I enjoy learning what I can by listening during my art period. I especially enjoy the wide variety of guests, but to my point, I really like number 173, Prison Dreams and Fairy Tales. I was intrigued, having heard very little about psychology in the prison system, and interested to hear more on the subject. Perhaps you might consider continuing in the same vein in the future. Merely a thought. Anyway, keep up the marvelous work, and I look forward to future podcasts. Best regards, HR. Wow, a freshman in high school. I think you might be my youngest listener. And what a literate note you have sent me. I really appreciate it, and I hope that you will continue to listen. And actually, your wish was recently granted, HR. I hope that you heard episode number 207, which was once again with Dana Houck, and life-changing lessons from hardcore cons. So check that one out if you haven't done so already. The next one reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Thanks for the Jung series details. We'll make sure to have a look in the university library next time I'm down in the city." By the way, this is from Brad of the Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt fame in Australia. And he goes on to say, "The university I attended last year, Queensland University of Technology, is a bit left of center, and their video library is pretty enormous. It's a long shot, but worth having a look." He's referring to a film series profiling Carl Jung that I had recommended to him. He goes on to say, "That's a bummer that Jerry didn't want to do the episode with you." He's referring to our 200th anniversary show. He says, "I really enjoy hearing the two of you converse. There were so many great episodes between number 100 and 200 that a retrospective is definitely warranted, in my humble opinion. I would love to hear some reflections on your personal favorites. Unfortunately, I'm not sure I would be too good a guest." Now, he's responding to, I had replied to him suggesting, well, since Jerry doesn't want to do a retrospective, maybe you'd like to do it with me. So Brad says, "Unfortunately, I'm not sure I would be too good a guest. It would certainly be fun to talk with you, however. I'm of a rather anxious temperament and afraid my nervousness would hinder the listening experience." He goes on the other hand, "If you decide to do it on your own and want a practice run, I would be happy to chat with you. You could tape it, and if it turned out okay, use it. Not sure if it would be a waste of time, though. Had better get back to cleaning, and I guess it was packing. We're moving house, and just heard my wife yell out for me. All the best, Brad." So, Brad, it's great to hear from you. Brad is an American living in Australia, and I think he has some interesting perspectives as a result of that. And I don't know, I think it's too late to rehash and go back and look over the last 100 shows, so I'm probably going to pass on that. Brandon, a librarian at a New Zealand mental health library, writes to say, "Your show has really changed my life. Many years ago, I shut out my sense of spirituality and creativity, particularly after looking into the New Age movement. Various practitioners and authors had put me off, even the idea of listening to my dreaming. But now, after listening to all your podcasts, I have a renewed sense of self, keep a dream journal, and am now training to be a counselor. Thank you so much. I recommend your show to many of our visitors and borrowers at our mental health library. I have attached a photo of a poster that I made for it in our library." And that's from Brandon. And of course, you can see that photo of the poster that he made on our site under, I think it's under the In the Media tab at the top of the page. By the way, you may be hearing some hammering in the background, and that's due to the fact that we have earthquake retrofit work being done on our house as I record this. Okay, I think we will finish it up with one more from longtime listener Rick, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I just finished listening to your interview with Dr. Burns and was struck by how refreshingly straightforward his approach to how we humans relate with one another is. However, I have a hard time with the whole blame thing. If we find ourselves either in a relationship with someone who is duplicitous or are treating a couple in which one is being duplicitous, is not the one who is being deceptive responsible for the poor outcome that is sure to manifest at some point in the future? Wouldn't placing the blame on the one being deceived be unjust and even cruel? Is it not possible to find ourselves in a situation that cannot be easily dissolved for moral reasons that are of hierarchical importance such that a man or woman that stays with an abusive partner to keep the family intact for the sake of minor children. The problem, as I see it, is in divining motives. Those who desire to have deeply meaningful relationships are to some degree at the mercy of fate. They may, unfortunately, end up meeting someone who wants a relationship for many reasons that have nothing to do with experiencing love and connectedness on a deep level. I don't think that Stacy Peterson, who, from what I can tell, was a very well-adjusted young woman, had a clue that her husband was the man he is. He's referring to the Scott Peterson case, which is a Bay Area murder case. Nor do I think that Scott Peterson revealed to her his true nature because he understood that she would surely reject him. Therefore, quite the opposite was true, and he did all he could to conceal who he was from her and present the image to her that she wanted to see. I realize that this is an extreme example, but I use it to point out the most sophisticated or well-intentioned person can find themselves in Stacy Peterson's situation and perhaps not end up murdered, but damaged in other ways that are quite devastating. Are they responsible for being deceived? Well, to some degree, they may share responsibility for the awful mess that they find themselves in because they perhaps ignored red flags. But then again, don't those in the healthiest of relationships overlook their partner's faults with a covering of love? This is where it gets complicated. How can we or a therapist know what's in the hearts of those persons they encounter? Well, the best way is by looking at our behavior, but even then, it's not always a sure indicator of motives. The fact is, we can't know, and that every one of us can be completely fooled by those whose motives are less than noble or even evil. Evil people don't typically go looking for those of like mind to have intimate relationships with, in which they are vulnerable, rather than seek out those who are naive and easily manipulated. I personally have lived with this situation and happily affixed blame to my former partner, who I never knew when we were together. Everything was smoke and mirrors. I consider myself to be very intelligent and intuitive, but nonetheless was completely fooled by my former partner. You can work on building a good relationship with a crocodile for as long as you like, but as soon as an opportunity avails itself, it will eat you. Finally, I think it's important that everyone understand, especially those who are young and forming their first intimate relationships, that these sorts of folks are out there, and that there are some flags to look for that are of particular importance. It's also important to understand that for many, intimacy and love are like poison. That notwithstanding, these people like some of the perks of being in a relationship and therefore will pursue relationships for practical considerations that have nothing to do with the mutual pursuit of the spiritual magic that can happen between two people committed to loving each other. The first key to relationship success is finding someone who is philosophically and spiritually committed to a higher good and sees their relationship with their intimate partner as an opportunity to grow closer to God and each other by overcoming their respective egos. This process involves cutting your partner a lot of slack for their flawed humanity, as well as them doing the same back to you, and there's the rub. In Buddhism, the goal is to see the world for how it is. This means embracing our responsibility for the quality of our relationships, but also seeing others as they truly are. There are other reasons why some don't want to be intimate that have nothing to do with evil, but does it really matter what the reason is? No. Therefore, we must be circumspect in our mating choices and listen to that still small voice in our hearts to guide us. In my opinion, that refined intuitive sense and voice stress analysis are our best bet in discerning the motives of prospective partners. Sincerely, Rick the Insomniac. Well, Rick, you raise some important points there and some warnings. I think you do describe maybe the extreme case, but the extreme case, as you point out, does at times happen. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to your emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod, and you're encouraged to leave voice messages using the MyChingo link on our site. And you can leave voicemail on our U.S. phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guests, Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster, for sharing their archetypal dreamwork approach with us. In response to a listener suggestion, our next episode will feature author and psychotherapist Dr. Ted Ziff speaking about the highly sensitive person. Are you a highly sensitive person? Tune in next time and find out. And please stick around after my sign-off for a couple of brief discount offers from our sponsors. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Save money on your next car rental by going to avis.com/shrink. Avis tries harder with knowledge, caring, and a passion for excellence. You'll get 10% off or $30 off a weekly rental by going to avis.com/shrink or using the Avis link on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. One of the ways you can support this show is by using our discount codes at GoDaddy.com, the world's largest provider of domain names and web services. I personally use GoDaddy.com, and so I feel good about recommending it to you. Go to our homepage and click on the GoDaddy banner on the right side of the page for info on our money-saving GoDaddy discount codes. Thank you.